Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex. And welcome back to On Air, ranking in the top 5% globally of all podcasts. May I just remind and also thank, because that wouldn't be possible without you guys, the amazing listener base that we've started to build. How are you, Dan?
I am great. I'm so happy we could make this work this week. I don't know what has been up with the past few weeks, but I feel like every week we're like, can't we find 45 minutes somewhere? And then it's like, let's cancel this and that plan because we really want to do the podcast.
It's like, I'm like, well, I have this connecting flight there. And if you're in Delhi, then you are plus 6 hours. Yeah. Then I'm like, then if boarding doesn't begin until T minus 40 to 40 minutes and I find a quiet space in the lounge, we have 38 minutes to do the podcast and 15 minutes. Literally, that's what goes into the planning sometimes.
Yeah. And you know how I've been hating on those little booths on my story the past week, like those little airport booths.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, wait a minute, that's the perfect place to record a podcast because aren't those soundproof?
They are soundproof. And I've done a lot of live broadcasts from those booths in the lounge before. For anyone that hasn't seen Dan's story, these are like these stand-up glass cubicles where you can go in and make a phone call rather than bother everyone else in the lounge.
Yeah. It looks like there's about 15 minutes worth of oxygen in there.
Well, I avoid them because I think, I don't know if the last guy just sneezed
with
the door shut, right? I'm like, that's not a very well-ventilated concept. So I do avoid them. But pre-pandemic, I do remember broadcasting a few, I think in the Brussels Airlines lounge of all places.
Mm.
How have you been? How are your travels? What has been happening? Because you also, in between last week's episode and this week's episode, have once again been basically around the world.
Yeah, pretty much. I've gone from one side of the world to another again. And I have to say, after flying 4 flights on American Airlines in the span of a week, it took me a while to recover. Because at first, like, you gaslight yourself into thinking, this is fine. This is at least decent value for money domestically. But then you hop on JFK Heathrow, which is like a $5,000 ticket in business for that route. And you end up being served by crew that couldn't care less. The food is something I literally would not feed to my pets. There's so many things where you're just like, this is so bad. And then the next day at Heathrow, I board Finnair, as I've been sharing all my stories. And literally, I'm not joking, when I board, and I was like, what is up with this crew? And I'm like, oh yeah, they're all smiling. That's the difference.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Huge beaming smiles as people step on board. I was like, whoa, this is so amazing. So yeah, again, I have to say, I don't understand how little Finnair, the little airline that could, can train crew.
Told you before, Finnair is not the little airline that could. That is Air Baltic. They are small. Finnair has Finnair's like 100 years old.
I know, but yeah, I guess they're the old airline that could, but it is pretty amazing being from the Nordics, knowing, you know, normally I feel like the service on SAS is very cold and impersonal. in general, the Nordics
you don't just feel like it, it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. And in general, I just feel like the Nordics are a very like cold place where people aren't very overly friendly unless they know you. So I just don't know how Finnair manages to make so many of their crew break out of that box.
The Finnair, the Mediterranean airline of the Nordics, maybe bringing that much needed southern Mediterranean warmth, you know, that Greece, Italy, precisely, southern Spain, you know.
Yeah, and then I actually connected on Air India out of Delhi. And even then I was like, Air India obviously doesn't have a good reputation. I was not on their A350. I was on an older aircraft. I'm going to share all this in a video and story, so I don't want to say too much yet. But literally, even Air India made me really impressed compared to the flights I'd had on American. I boarded, I was like, whoa, this is nice.
Wow. I mean, what you have flown over the last couple of weeks, or the last few weeks, I feel more US flights than in previous months, or even I remember since we basically started the podcast.
Yeah.
Have they, in your perception, because uniquely you do fly everywhere and everything, right?
Yeah.
So you always get those that have this strong take on, here's what United is doing and investing in and blah, blah, blah. But they never fly, for example, in India or the Gulf or South Asia and so on and so on. So uniquely you do. Are they better than they were pre-pandemic, or, you know, are we taking the pee and exaggerating all the time? Because, and I'm asking you because, you know, the last time I flew a US carrier, I mean, I don't even remember, does Air Canada count?
No.
it's been a while. Yeah.
So I would say American Airlines is uniquely below the rest. They really don't seem to care. I mean, I've stood up for American carriers on the podcast. I've made shorts and reels about how I think they compete very well with European carriers. But I think when I say that, I kind of am mainly talking about United and Delta and JetBlue, those types of airlines. And I kind of tend to forget American because they're so far behind in some ways. And then the difference is, if you get a New York-based crew like I do, New Yorkers are already like some of the rudest people in the world, which I love when I'm in New York because it's kind of like the vibe of everyone being so pissed all the time. That's how my family is who live there. But when you're on a plane, that's not what you want. And I've like all the past long haul flights I've taken with Americans since COVID have been out of Dallas or Miami. And those long haul crews were great, or at least pretty good compared to New York based. So it depends on so many factors, but I will say that it's just like it is quite unfortunate, the state of many airlines, not just American, but, you know, I flew over the Atlantic on British Airways. And again, I just felt like this crew, even after landing, I was discussing with one of the flight attendants. She was like, yeah, you know, I have a friend who was, because we told her about our itinerary. And she's like, yeah, you know, I have some friends who always fly from Stockholm or Copenhagen, even though they live in the UK, because tickets are £2,000 across the Atlantic instead of 7,000.
Yeah.
So she knows how much it costs, yet the entire flight she was delivering Ryanair level service. So I was like, what's up with this? Like, you literally just acknowledge the cost, but you couldn't seem to care less.
Way, I mean, it's the thing about airlines like BA, isn't it? It's a mixed picture in 100%. Terms of who you're going to be engaging with. Some, they've got some of the best staff in the world. They also have some on the other end of the scale. I want to quickly pick you up on the fact that you're a Swede New Yorker, so you can say it, right? And you just made a funny observation about how you feel that in New York, everyone is
I don't remember exactly.
You said something about everyone being moody or everyone being aggressive, right? But yeah, I feel like that if you take, for example, a British family and you take them to New York for the first time, they're walking around like, wow, it's like a movie because of the accents and the larger than life. It feels so much more larger than life than, for example, a modest Brit thing. I remember being a young teenager, and the first time I ever went to New York. And when I walked out of the hotel, I was in a electric blue suit. We were going to an event. And as I walked out of the hotel, within a split second, a guy, you know how everybody in New York walks fast, which I can respect a lot because I'm a fast walker. So this guy walks fast past me really quickly, and I've just stepped out of the hotel. I've been in New York for 5 minutes, and he goes, "Nice suit, brother." And keeps walking. Yeah. And I remember standing up saying, "God, I love New York."
But the thing is, he could have just as well said, "I effing hate your suit, brother," and kept walking. So
basically, I'm lucky that I got that side of the coin and not the other.
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get, which is kind of part of the fun. But yeah, it doesn't work as well when it comes to customer service, especially premium experiences. And I have some friends who live in New York who do like staycations at Four Seasons and stuff. And they're like, you'll get better service at a Holiday Inn Express in most of the world than you do at a Four Seasons in New York City. So that says a lot. Yeah.
Interesting.
So I've seen you've been very busy the past week. Actually, I was at a conference last weekend, but you were just gearing up for, I think, a much bigger conference. Tell me, what has that been like? What did you do? Who did you meet?
So I flew to London. A350-1000, XWB.
Of course.
One of the favorite aircraft.
God forbid you're on a 900.
Oh, Anyway, I have the talking stick. flew to London for the UK's largest sustainability conference. This is a massive summit that gathers a whole variety, array of industry, not just aviation. Definitely not aviation, it's just one part of it, but everything that involves any entity now basically has sustainability goals. They were all there, from rail to banks to supermarkets to big accountancy corporate firms. They were being represented, they were having discussions, and there were loads of government ministers, members of parliament, different government officials from the UK government, the outgoing Tory government, from the most likely incoming next government, and also foreign delegates, very government, but also loads of private sector, as I said there. And it was a mixture of meetings and networking. And there were about maybe 8 stages, I think, of different talks and panel discussions. I hosted 11. So I hosted around 11 different people on stage, wow, on the aviation stage, for discussions on where we are with sustainable aviation. And specifically, I was hosting panels on SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, which of course is that fuel that in some pathways comes from recycled cooking oil, and it's able to reduce emissions almost from the get-go, sometimes by up to around 70-80%. It's incredibly expensive. That's why it's not in use everywhere, but it is one of the vital tools for aviation to decarbonize. That's the sustainable aviation fuel. The other side of things, I was also hosting panels on hydrogen and how we will eventually, I mean, some of the stakeholders were telling me by late 2030s be flying by hydrogen, at least, yes, on smaller aircraft. And that's going to be really interesting because that's basically clean green flight by definition. There are other complications, but there are more complications with SAF in terms of, for example, there is not enough chip fat oil in the country to be able to recycle it into aircraft fuel. And therefore, what are you doing elsewhere? And what waste are you creating elsewhere by trying to make that conversion and so on, yeah, and so on? So there's all kinds of complications. I had guests from the aviation, from the airline side of the aviation sector. So I was interviewing one of the VPs from IAG, of course, the parent company of BA Iberia, Vueling, Level, Aer Lingus. And they are one of the biggest purchasers of SAF. I had the head of Net Zero, the head of sustainability of EasyJet. I had, and he's very, very focused on hydrogen. I had even small airlines represented. I had the head of sustainability for Logan Air, this small Scottish regional, nice, carrier. And of course, they will be, you know, people think, okay, Logan Air, what does Logan Air have to say about sustainability? Well, the answer is a lot, because if we're going to get these clean green aircraft, for example, entirely powered by hydrogen, it is going to be way earlier for the smaller guys, for the smaller players, the turboprop, the regional aircraft with around, you know, 15 passengers on board. So airlines like Logan Air, that a lot of people rely on in the Highlands and across Scotland, they are going to be at the front of the queue when it comes to being a customer for clean green aircraft. And so as a result, they're actively sitting on the board. They are there at the front, part of their decision making of future investments with hydrogen and so on and so on. So it was really interesting. It's great to, I like hosting these panel discussions. I like being able to pinpoint them, to play devil's advocate. And I did push and I was firm, and, you know, they would sit there and I'd have different think tanks from Europe or different lobbyist groups, different developers of these clean, green, sustainable aircraft like Zero Avia, LanzaJet, LanzaTech, and so on and so on. These are big names in the industry. And they would say, well, Alex, you know, what we really need is we need to come together for support. And I'm like, hold on, support. Everyone's throwing around this word support. You need cash, right? Yeah. And you don't want to pay despite the fact that you are extremely profitable. So you want the energy companies to pay, I'm assuming. The energy companies say, we're doing the hard work. We're already developing it. Your governments have the climate change mandates. Let them pay. The governments say, well, you know, look at us. We've got all this situation. The economy's in a bad way. Cost of living crisis. The airlines made billions last year. Let the airlines pay. The airlines, they point back to the energy companies. We're in a vicious cycle. The conclusion after this conference, which I already knew, is the same as always. Nobody wants to pay. And until they figure that out, we will be in deadlock. That's the kind of Alex harsh reality version of, you know, I played the diplomat on stage, but then I kept concluding and kept breaking in and saying, actually, let's keep it real. Let's be realistic. I mean, some of the stuff we heard as well, I had guests from the Airport Association, I had guests from Luton Airport and so on, and they're speaking about how they're confident that the government is going to be able to ensure that the infrastructure is there for us to be able to deliver sustainable aviation. And I'm asking, is this the same government that mandated that all UK airports are going to have the new updated, must have the new updated security scanners so that passengers don't have to take out their liquids or laptops by the summer of 2024? We are at the summer of 2024 and all the airports, basically all of them, have told the UK government, we know it was a mandate, but sorry, we shrugged our shoulders. Sorry, we're missing it. And that's it. We're not doing anything about it. That same set up, that same government, I'm supposed to, that relationship, I'm supposed to have faith in decarbonizing us in the future if they can't implement the scanners that Rome have had forever?
I have to say, just quickly, last week when I flew out of, or not last week, a few days ago when I flew out of Heathrow Terminal 3, the priority line there now has those scanners. But what I found so interesting, it was my first time using them, is that there was no signs, no acknowledgement anywhere about the liquids. So the only thing that was different was that there were no plastic bags to put your liquids in. So I was like, that's interesting, because I have a lot of liquids. They usually are very strict with that at Heathrow. Mm. So I realized this must be the new scanner. I asked and they said, oh yeah, it is. Just very, you know, like it was nothing. I was like, this is a very huge blase deal.
Yeah. That's like two things you need to communicate in aviation. Firstly, you need to communicate clearly. Rome do a great job at Fiumicino. There's signs everywhere informing people you can leave everything in your bag. And what a pleasant sign to read as you're approaching the security queue. It's really, really well signposted. Okay. So that's Rome. That needs to be communicated. What also needs to be communicated, we've spoken before about the airlines that take the XL overhead lockers, meaning if you put the bag on the side, everybody can fit their stuff in. And the airlines, imagine, they invest in these lockers. They are a fortune. And then they don't bother putting a sticker that says, hey guys, you can just turn the bag on the side and then you can all fit it. The US carriers do a great job when it comes to that. I think here they're just far too modest. And we hope Jennifer will be able to figure out how to put her bag in. But if she does not, all will be well and we will continue. Yeah. It's like, no, you need to be explaining every step of the way to passengers, because for some reason, you know, when you take the control out of their hands, 50% of the flight get airport brain and they don't remember why they're there. And the other 50%, maybe they don't fly often. So they genuinely need to be told.
Exactly. Well, just going back to what you were saying about sustainable flying, I feel like Gothenburg is going to be one of the first cities to get some hydrogen powered little props.
God,
and
I think you're right.
I am excited about that.
I think there we go. We will find Gothenburg's relevance and niche here on the podcast, on air, the top five globally ranking podcast with Dan and Alex, because if the little, maybe Gothenburg will be the little airport that could, right? Yeah. It will become a hub for hydrogen. Sounds flammable. But
connecting
anyway.
What regions? I do not know.
Yeah, a hub for interconnectivity across Gothenburg and
across
beyond.
Across the Gothenburg
never,
region.
Across the Gothenburg region, and they'll never exactly specify what that means. But hey, it would allow you to come onto the podcast and refer to it as a hub.
Yeah.
And it will be factually true. So there we go. Speaking of hubs in general, of course, the Gulf being a key player of the whole hub and spoke model, lots of news. In fact, some of the only news this week coming out of the Gulf. I'll begin in Oman, where I exclusively revealed on Twitter that Con Korfiadis, the former CEO of Saudi low-cost airline Flyadeal. Have you flown Flyadeal?
Yes, Flyadeal and Flynas. So I'm pretty well-versed in Saudi Arabian
airlines. What was your Flyadeal experience like?
Flyadeal was bad. I flew Flynas to Saudi Arabia, and you can, at least then, I could upgrade very cheap to their business class, which is basically inter-European, but it was comfy and the upgrade was like $40 for a 2-hour flight. So it was a no-brainer. Very nice.
That's good. Well, that CEO, he's Aussie.
The CEO of Flyadeal, not Flynas.
The CEO of Flyadeal, sorry, yes. Greek Aussie, I believe. He has been appointed, I exclusively revealed on Twitter that he has been appointed the new CEO of Oman Air, which of course is undergoing that big restructuring right now and slashing this and phasing out that. And if you remember before, it was Abdulaziz Al-Raisi, but he was let go by the board and they haven't really had a CEO since then. There was just kind of an acting CEO, but not much was happening. It's basically a consulting company that is running the show at Oman Air now, Oliver Wyman. They are the consulting company that have taken the sledgehammer to everything in a bid for financial health at Oman Air. I told you, we've discussed it before. We don't need to go too much into it. I disagree with a lot of the strategy, but I'm also confident that Con will be able to regain some control and take Oman Air to smoother ground. I literally see this as, I mean, talk about trying to fix something that's not broken. They have made out that Oman Air was in this just huge issue and disarray of all these things. There was nothing wrong. Sure, they didn't make any money. Most Gulf airlines do not. Right. And there are ways in which that they could make money, but to behave as if suddenly they've woken up to an airline that this is wrong and this is wrong. It just wasn't the case. The CEO is joining. He's held multiple positions, senior positions at low cost carriers and startups, including Jetstar Asia, Viva Macau, Garuda, the subsidiary CityLink. Oh, CityLink. So yep. We add CityLink to the, because last week we spoke about City Airlines. Yeah. There you go. There's an Indonesian version. I forgot CityLink.
Yeah,
they have
quite
a nice livery. And of course, most recently, Flyadeal in Saudi Arabia. And a quick roundup at Oman Air. All the 330s are out of the fleet. A lot of the route network has been slashed, including Colombo and Islamabad. Chittagong, I believe, as well. Dozens of crew have very sadly been informed that they've been made redundant. Flight frequencies on existing routes that are staying have been reduced and cut. And the Chelsea Football Club deal, which is something like less than a year old, was also terminated, again, in this bid for financial health.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the region, another airline is going to be growing like crazy. Emirates this week.
Yeah.
Has announced their plans for the A350. And we were saying that earlier. It feels so weird to say Emirates and A350 in the same sentence.
Doesn't it? Yeah. It's just because Emirates A380 is how it rolls off of the tongue. Not Emirates A350. But what did you think when you saw the inaugural A350 destination?
Bahrain. I mean, in a way, it makes sense for crew training purposes.
Of course.
Airlines add short flights so they, more crew can get familiar with the aircraft. Kuwait is being launched the day after Bahrain. So we have two very short routes there. And I imagine they'll be using one aircraft for just those two little daily frequencies. Then we have India. And then we add some European routes finally in December and onwards. So,
and of course, Emirates returning to Edinburgh and returning to Edinburgh with the A350, which is really nice for the Edinburgh market. The flight times look decent as well. Of course, it is launching, as you say, on those tiny intra-Gulf routes because of the crew familiarization flight purpose, so that get the crew familiar. Dubai to Bahrain being just 260 nautical miles. So by the time you even acknowledge you're on a 350, it's time to get off.
Yeah.
I, I wonder if people will be booking. I've already seen a few people that have booked this up now. So maybe turnarounds, things like that could be quite a good use of time.
Yeah.
Wait a second. Are you doing it?
No, I was thinking about doing it yesterday. I was tempted.
You should.
I
looked, you should.
But I'm not into this, like, chasing the newest and being the first to try
okay,
it anymore.
Okay, don't go on the first flight. Go on the second flight.
I know. That was actually my thought. But
yeah,
that was very me back in the day. But these days, I'm just like, actually, I don't know what More I'll be doing in September. Maybe I want to be in Bali or New Zealand. Like, I don't just want to be flying back and forth from Dubai to Bahrain.
Okay, but the beauty of it is that if you happen to find yourself in the region that you are in a lot, it's a nice, easy, you know.
Yeah,
easy...
you know what they need to launch? This is the perfect chance to relaunch Doha. A350 to Doha.
A lot of people tweeted that to me. They were saying, it's funny how, you know, Emirates hasn't flown to Doha since the blockade 2017, right? And Fly Dubai, the sister of Emirates, fly to Doha. But for some reason, I don't know why, the announcement of the A350, suddenly my messages were flooded again. Why don't Emirates fly to Doha? Emirates should fly to Doha. Emirates should use this as an opportunity to return to Doha. And I was thinking, isn't it funny? So you just had that same reaction. I don't know why, an A350 and you think of Doha.
No, because they're flying it to, I mean, Bahrain, Kuwait. There's some reason they don't fly to Doha. I mean, partly I do think that Qatar Airways succeeds more in Dubai because there are a lot of tourists going to Dubai. Of course, there are a lot of people traveling between these countries, but I think just the market for connecting traffic to Qatar is not big enough to have multiple daily frequencies on a 777. Even an A350 is big, but at least it's a bit smaller so they can, you know, inch back into that market.
Yeah. And it's launching. This is all launching when?
So the first flights are September 15th. What kind of is driving me crazy? I think it's driving everyone crazy. What's that? Woo! So it's driving me crazy. That
for anyone, you know, young, that's September, Earth, Wind and Fire. Legendary tune.
Absolutely. This is basically a celebratory tune.
Emirates in September. Yeah. There we go. But go on, you were saying.
Everyone is dying to know what these cabins will look like. And we have no clues besides a seat map, which shows a staggered configuration that could be anything. It could be just the same seat they have on the A380, or it could be pretty much the room which ANA has on their 777s, which is one of the very best, probably one of the two best business class seats in the world. So we don't know. We can only hope that Emirates, you know, goes big or goes home. But I don't know. Emirates is a very conservative airline when it comes to, you know, innovating too much.
So Safran are the seat supplier. And of course, they make incredible seats. But crucially, this will not be an off-the-shelf product. So
do we know
Emirates
that?
Emirates is working with Safran on a fully bespoke product for the carrier. Now, usually that doesn't mean that it's, of course, starting from scratch and a clean white canvas and they draw up these designs, but rather starting from a product that they have and then starting the modifications and heavily modified, heavily customized, so that then it actually doesn't resemble anything like the on-the-shelf product. So I do know that it is absolutely bespoke, but at the same time, Emirates is already an existing customer of Safran, and while some of their other seats are technically bespoke and customized, they're just, you know, customized evolutions of what is available in the catalog. And by the way, guys, if you go back to a previous episode, the name of it was something like How Do You Buy a Plane or something. We've spoken about how airlines make these decisions. If I have an airline, I have a choice. I can choose a product that is from the catalog on the shelf. And there are thousands to choose from in terms of, let's say, a business class seat. Thousands of different designs of business class seats. But also, if I want to be extra, I can take that design and heavily modify and customize it so that it becomes something aligned with my vision. Or I can literally build a seat from scratch, something that is patented and bespoke, such as the Q Suite, for example. The Q Suite is not from the shelf. It's not in the catalog. There are many, many examples of seats that are not. The first class suite that Emirates have is not from the catalog. Lufthansa's Allegris is a customized product. I mean, it doesn't look like it, but it is. So that's the decision making behind, and we're going to learn more about it going forward.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see it. One thing I find so fascinating, which I just want to talk quickly about, is I've really come to accept that airlines in the Middle East do not care about consistency at all. That's just, to me, I see it as a cultural thing now, because I've realized that in the Middle East, you build a mall and then you start building the next mall. And then that mall opens and becomes the It Mall, and everyone forgets about the old mall. Then a new mall starts being built and everyone wants to go there because that's the new It Mall. And then everyone forgets about the last two. It's not like in the West where it's like, how about we refurbish the existing mall and make it nicer? No, it's like, we just got to make it new and fresh and leave the old thing where it is much of the time. And that same mentality permeates airlines, where it's like, you know, Qatar Airways, I think, is the most extreme example, having more than 10 different business class seats in their fleet. And it doesn't seem to be a concern for anyone running the airline, but for passengers from maybe Europe who want to have that consistency, or from anywhere, I think it's obviously a frustration that I don't think most of the airlines in this region seem to understand.
I think you're right. And Almir, the CEO of Qatar Airways, commented on it briefly, didn't he, in the CNBC interview he did in March, commenting on how he wanted consistency, because he had said in the longer interview, not in the clips that went round, he said that he recognised that consistency was absolutely necessary. It's also what the people wanted. That was definitely a nod to the fact that there are just this variety of products. Yeah, you're right. I think the consistency element is definitely taken a bit more seriously outside of the region and across Europe, and certainly across different international carriers that don't touch the Gulf.
I mean, also in Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, Singapore Airlines has two types of business class seats, and they're very, very similar. Oh, actually, they have three, one regional.
Three,
one,
yeah, but they have three. Yeah.
But the two used for long haul flights are very, very similar, and one is only on the A380. So to me, it doesn't really matter which one of those I get. They have also two types of first class, but they're consistent across aircraft types. We have Thai Airways with, actually, they have three different seats. So now I'm thinking about it. It's quite rare for an airline only to have one seat, which you got to say is impressive, that United, for example, manages to have the exact same seat on every single wide body they have in their massive, massive fleet.
Yeah, no, it's definitely something. It is. Okay, let's go into some Q&A. I have a question here from Ali.
And he begins his question by absolutely roasting you, Dan. And he makes various comments about how he would love his message to have been read out on the podcast, including how he thinks it's a great idea for the Alex Macheras show and for me to only be talking to myself back and forth. And he's putting in brackets, this is to tease Dan, by the way.
Yeah.
But it is a great podcast, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, he's put, can you ask Dan, did he know that Iran Air once ran one to three weekly flights on an A330-200 to the New York of the 21st and the 22nd centuries, but the city of Gothenburg?
I did. Those were good times. No, I mean, yeah, of course I knew about this. This was like the biggest, the most exciting plane to fly to Gothenburg consistently, but it's not really any use to anyone not going to Iran, right? You can't even book Iran Air flights online. You have to use a travel agency. Forget about connecting in Iran. Add in the safety issues. Their A330 was one thing since it was very new, but for a long time they flew A300s or A310s to Gotham. Yeah, I think
you used to see them at Hamburg.
Yeah,
The city has, you know, for context, but the city has a sizable immigrant population, and the flight was canned for obvious reasons. In brackets, he's put aging and tiny fleet due to the sanctions, load factors of under 60%, and the often not mentioned lack
of a pro aviation business environment in Gothenburg.
Yes, very true. But I mean, let's be honest, even if you're going to visit Iran from Gothenburg, would you rather fly an Iran Air A300 that probably hasn't been very well maintained, has been flying around for 30 years, or fly Turkish Airlines via Istanbul on beautiful modern planes? Not a difficult choice that you can book online.
Max asks us, and he also joined somebody else who asked us this last week. So if this was you, you're both asking the same thing, so I'll group it together. Max says, hi, I love the podcast. Why do airlines in the US, for example, set departures at such odd times, like 10:24 or 6:59? While in most European countries, they're mostly, he's put even, but it's not, they're in blocks of five, aren't they? Like 10:25 or 7. He's put greetings from the Netherlands. Max, Dan and I were discussing this off the podcast just a few weeks ago. It's bizarre. We find it bizarre. The US airlines justify that it's because we're working, you know, to the T, and it's for more precision, and it would be crazy to have 10 departures all scheduled for 11:05. When you could have one at 11:01, three at 11:02, and so on and so on. So they believe that it is better. I think the rest of the world looks at them and thinks it's absolutely bizarre. Because to see a 10:26 flight, I'm like, you're not pushing back. And then, of course, the US airlines go justify it even harder. They say, well, hold on. If you expect to push back at 10:05 on the dot, that is the same unit measurement as, for example, pushing back at 10:07. But for us, 10:07 just looks weird. What do you think?
Like, it just cracks me up. I read people's arguments about this, and it's just like, you can't have 20 flights push back at the same time. It's like, so
if they don't.
Yeah, like if they're scheduled at 1:05, 1:06, 1:07, 1:08, they're all going to push back around the same time anyway. Why does it matter that it's like, this is how it works at huge airports all around the world. In Doha, you know, in the Middle East, but especially Doha, planes are so heavily banked that you have so many planes pushing back in the span of 10 minutes, you know, huge wide bodies. And it works fine. They still don't need to schedule one to push back at 8:04.
I see 10:24 and I'm thinking that's a train, right? Yeah. That's not a plane. That's a train on tracks.
That is quite representative of how the US treats domestic travel, especially.
True.
It's just very,
maybe we
very
can late. Ask Secretary Buttigieg when we get him on the podcast.
Yeah, maybe we'll make him ban those weird departure times.
No way. For some reason, as we both saw, people felt very passionate about this. Yeah. We were reading Reddit threads and all sorts, and people were defending it and saying, well, departing at 7 is exactly the same as a flight scheduled to depart at 7:01. So what is the issue? And, you know, the rest of us who are not in that bubble just found it a bit bizarre.
Yeah.
Ernie says, funny story. He's put, yesterday I was flying BA from Heathrow to Hong Kong when I saw that our flight was assigned gate C10. Then I just happened C-10. To speak to a C10. He's put, then I just happened to speak to a rep because I wanted to get escorted to the Cathay lounge in T3.
Oh, I didn't know that was possible if you're already in T5, but...
So if you're airside in T5, you can go airside to T3?
I mean, I guess theoretically, but that is extremely time-consuming and risky. So what's the next thing he said?
Well, he didn't say that it wasn't possible. He said, he then mentioned your new gate is A10. I immediately screamed inside because I immediately knew what that meant. The damn bus gate. Hold on. Sorry, Ernie, I know you were messaging to joke with us about A10, but were you at A10 because that's where you were boarding the connection bus to go to T3?
Yes. Yeah, that's where it leaves from, right?
So they would actually let you leave airside of T5 to go to T3 airside, only to have to return to T5 airside?
Let us know, please, because now I'm
yes,
very
that's something
curious.
I need to find out. I have never heard that. Your flight is departing from T5. Yeah, so Ernie, you sent it as a joke and you've absolutely blown our minds. We're
like
going to have to wait for him to get
ever.
In touch. I'm going to have to reply saying you need to reply to this buddy because
I have a question here from, I'm so sorry, I don't know how to pronounce this name. I'm going to say Hrachia. I don't know. Hrachya. Thank you for your message. He says, hi, Dan. Love your channel and love your podcast with Alex. This is something I wanted to discuss today, actually. He says, I have a question for you two regarding Boeing. Today, the second whistleblower from Boeing Joshua Dean died.
God.
This is the second whistleblower, he says in 1 year, but it's actually much less than a year.
It is less, yeah.
To have died mysteriously after voicing concerns about the 737 MAX. What do we think about this?
Well, this is obviously deeply concerning, isn't it? Because, of course, while on one side you have different entities and, of course, the coroners, the police departments and so on explaining that this is a matter-of-fact scenario that shouldn't be linked. But then there's like everyone else, who's including us, staring at this saying, but this is, how is this the second?
Like, how many whistleblowers are there? That's
well, there are a lot of whistleblowers. There are a lot of whistleblowers. There are, and there are a lot that are engaged in legal depositions and legal cases and so on as they bring to light what is happening with Boeing. But this is obviously awful, deeply uncomfortable, and
yeah,
there's not much else we can comment in, you know, given the lack of any other facts at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, removing ourselves from the whole Boeing situation, it's very sad, of course, that this man Joshua Dean has died. Our thoughts are with him and his family, but it is scary and a bit, you know, it's hard not to become a little bit of a conspiracy theorist about this and think, well, that's awfully coincidental. At the same time, I can see exactly what it would be like inside Boeing. Perhaps they saw he had died, and the reaction there must just be like, are you kidding me? Like, this is this cannot be happening.
And they said that this gentleman was very suddenly unwell, and some of the details are deeply unpleasant about the critical condition that he very quickly ended up in after what they say is contracting a kind of influenza, and then
wasn't MRSA. It a kind of food poisoning?
It was an infection, yeah, and then it just kind of seemed to snowball and snowball and snowball. A CT scan showed that he had also suffered a stroke, and then it just worse and worse and worse. And the sister-in-law posted on Facebook that even the hospital were kind of staggered at this awful, shocking deterioration. Joshua Dean, the individual, was a former quality auditor at a Boeing supplier, Spirit Aerosystems. Spirit, of course, make key components for the aircraft, including key parts of the fuselage. They are a huge supplier under immense scrutiny for the quality flaws in new Boeing aircraft, specifically around the 737 MAX. So obviously a pretty disturbing what they say is a coincidence.
Yeah.
And of course, there are no other facts to suggest that it wasn't just a coincidence. But it is the second whistleblower in less than 3 months.
Yes. Let's hope that's the last and we don't have any more tragic events like this.
While we are speaking about Boeing, just to just quickly stay on Boeing, I want to bring you this bit of breaking news, which is that the FAA has opened a new investigation into a potential manufacturing quality lapse, so another quality flaw, on the 787 Dreamliner. The FAA investigating whether or not inspection records that cleared the 787 for safety, for, you know, ultimately to be able to go and be delivered to airline customers, whether those inspection documents were actually false, whether they were falsified, faked during the inspection process. Boeing says this is not an immediate safety of flight issue. The FAA is investigating. This investigation is running in parallel with all of the other investigations. And this is specifically now about the 787 Dreamliner and those that are pumped out of South Carolina. Again, concerning. We're going to learn more about it over the coming days. And I mean, Boeing continues to face scrutiny left, right, and center.
100%.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. Just quickly today, guys, unfortunately, we have quite a short episode because we're both very, very busy. Alex has to run. But I just read, literally as we're recording, Oman Air increases peak summer 24 service to several markets.
That's the effect of the new CEO.
Yeah. So he came back and he's like, okay, we're literally the again. Changes we just made. Let's reverse them. So I see Bangkok, Dar es Salaam and Zanzibar, Milan, Phuket, Kuala Lumpur.
Makes sense. Makes sense. They didn't need to be reduced in the first place. The fact that those that were running the airline until this CEO arrived, which is, he's only been there a few minutes, but the fact that those so far decided that this is why Oman Air is not profitable. We for example, we fly to Europe too much. Well, you know, European flights for almost all carriers just tend to do very well since the pandemic. Load factors are very high. Airlines are incredibly profitable in those areas of their route network and so on and so on. So it's just, yeah, I hope that this is, I saw that announcement too and I thought, okay, that's interesting. That's a funny little announcement that is as if the CEO has come in and said, hold on guys, what do you mean you slash this? It's summer. Ramp it up. You know, we've got passengers who want to fly.
Yeah, 100%. So on that note, thank you so much for joining us today, guys.
Please feel free to send in your questions. We love the scenario questions. We love answering your queries and all things related to air travel. And as Dan said, we look forward to joining you again this time next week. Yep. Thank you very much.
And we will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.